the weekend, and that means new movies are out, which means only one thing. Welcome to John Serba Hates Your Favorite Movie.
I'm very excited about this. This will be fun. Or should I not be excited about it?
I would love it if you would be excited about it. At least you'd be excited about something. So. And now, John Serba Hates Your Favorite Movie.
Well, hi there.
Hello there.
I'm John Serba, and I hate your favorite movie. I'm here with Eric Hultgren. We are catching up after some time away. I hope you guys caught up with the last episode where we sliced Suicide Squad into 1,000 pieces.
And I'm not actually sure if people actually missed us that much or hated Suicide Squad that much, but we already, since yesterday, for all of the episodes, have gotten a ton more feedback from the long break, so I don't know if it's because they missed us or they just hated that movie, but the kind words were nice, so thank you.
Oh, well, no, they were really fired up about the Werner Herzog.
Yep, that was it. They all lined up to see the internet documentary. That's what they were there for.
For sure. Anyway, we'll get into Hands of Stone, the Roberto Duran biopic. We'll touch on Kubo and the Two Strings, a new animated film that debuted a week ago, and Ben-Hur. We'll touch Ben-Hur in a little while. But I want to kick off with, you and I, just like we had to shut each other up so we could talk about this when we were actually recording horror films. And the new one in theaters this week is called Don't Breathe. It's from Fede Alvarez, who directed the Evil Dead remake, which I actually liked. And I use the word actually because I am not a horror movie fan. Horror movies, to me, if it's just a straight up, you know, blood and guts and gore, torture porn, trying to scare you with demons kind of stuff, I don't have time for that crap. I want funny horror or suspense. And Don't Breathe is it's not a slasher movie. This is like a hardcore suspense thriller more than anything else. One of the things I liked about it is that Alvarez, he has no use for ghosts, goblins, demons, witches, or any other thing. There are no cats jumping out of closets. there are no scenes of people walking very slowly through the house and reaching for a doorknob. he has no time for that kind of cliche. No supernatural stuff. And this is why it works for me, I think. Yeah, I mean, if you really want to slice and dice it, it exists to kind of put you through the ringer like a horror movie should. Because it's throwing surprises at you and things like that. But rooting it in the real world makes it scary. I do not think... don't throw a ghost at me. Ghosts aren't real. Ghosts are not real. I'm sorry to tell you this. They are not real. There's not a shred of evidence that ghosts exist. So,
are there shreds of evidence that prove that they don't exist, though?
You can't prove something does not.
That's very philosophical of you, but I don't know that I agree. Like, just because you can't prove it's there doesn't mean it isn't.
You can't prove...
this is going to get awesome,
okay,
by the way.
Okay, Eric. Okay, prove that Brad Pitt is not in this room right now. Scientifically,
he's not in this room right now.
Sure, but you can't prove a negative. You can only prove a positive. It's a logical conundrum. we're talking pure science here. We're talking pure science.
I don't know that we're talking pure science, but this is not what this show does. So, like, I do not. Well,
that's like the argument between religious people and non-religious people. Non-religious people are like, prove that God exists and I will believe in God. And non-religious people say, prove that God doesn't exist. And you can't prove that something doesn't exist.
See? I told you.
It is a logical, you know, contradiction to prove that something does not exist.
Okay, fair enough. We will agree to disagree about this ghost thing. But I am super excited to see this movie.
Yeah.
I of the people on the show, I will watch every horror thing ever just because I genuinely enjoy the genre. And my favorite thing, actually, and I'm pretty sure, and I know I may have asked you this at least once or 250,000 times, but I'm pretty sure there has to be a film school word for the first 10 minutes that sets up what the things, because they always have that first 10 minutes of the ghost, the demon, the door, the whatever. And those are my favorite things to kind of judge what's going to happen for the next 90 minutes to two hours, is that can they pull off what happens in that 10 minutes? Can they carry that through?
Just like setting up and establishing a premise, essentially.
Yeah, but they seem to like cram all of this horror into 8 or 9 minutes, and then the credits start, and then the movie starts. And I tend to judge the length and the success of said movie by the first setup scene.
Yeah.
And if they can keep it. Well, because anyone can make an 8-minute scary as hell sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Can you then do it 10 times more for another 90 minutes?
Well, I know exactly what you mean. It's almost like a pre-credit sequence. But like...
Like Darkness Falls is like the one that I refer to a lot, because it's the witch shows up in the tower and like kills the guy in the first 10 minutes. And then it's like you said, it's a pre-movie scene. And then can the movie live up to the terror that you have in the first 8 minutes? Jaws... eating the woman that goes skinny dipping.
Exactly.
Right? Can you keep that intensity going for 90 minutes?
Yeah. Well, two examples of this, of recent horror movies that I loved. Did you see It Follows?
No, I did not see
It
Follows.
Okay, you need to get off your butt and go and watch that this weekend. Interesting thing about It Follows and Don't Breathe is that they both are set in Detroit. And
oh, wow.
It Follows was filmed completely in Detroit. Don't Breathe has, like, the external stuff is shot in Detroit. There isn't a whole lot of that. But anyway, It Follows opens with one really long shot. The camera just spins, you know, as the girl runs out of the house screaming. And it's establishing, you know, whatever lurking thing is causing her to do this. And Don't Breathe opens with... like a helicopter shot above a neighborhood, a Detroit street, where it's just kind of overgrown with weeds and it's really quiet, and you hear a siren pretty far in the background. So you have that sense of isolation. It slowly zooms down, and in the middle of the road is a man dragging a blonde girl by the hair. Like, and he can do this in the middle of the road,
right?
And no one is there to see it. So there you go.
And these are the things that I love about this genre, is that.
That is nothing compared to the rest of the movie.
Awesome.
I will say that.
Can't
right
even
now.
Wait.
I think what I need for a horror movie to function is that kind of filmmaker technique that allows you to willingly be manipulated, you know, but not to the point where you can see through it and say, okay, well, the cat's going to jump out of the closet,
the door's going to slam, or what?
Know, where you can predict things, and he does a really good job of like maintaining focus and intensity through like just lighting and camera angles and things like that, that the average person may not realize that they're being manipulated by these things. But like there's a great sequence. Well, I'll get to that in a minute. But there's got to be some kind of skill to it. It Follows had these long shots that were kind of like... You're looking at the screen and you know something is there. You're trying to catch whatever the it is that's following these teenagers, trying to catch it in the corner of the screen, you know, just catch a glimpse of it. Is it there or not? They are being followed. Where is it? Who is it? What does it look like? That kind of thing. Don't Breathe is kind of the opposite in that it's really fast paced, but it's not hectic, you know? I had heard some buzz ahead of time, like, this is a great horror movie. You got to see this. This is one of the best horror movies you'll see all year, all that kind of stuff. And about, you know, maybe the first quarter to a third of it, I'm like, I don't know. But it really ramps up, you know, maybe a third to halfway through. Alvarez just, like, pedal to the metal. But it's not just always that, like, chase. The premise of the movie is you have three, I'm going to call them teenagers, who, you know, they are serial burglars. One of them, his dad works for a home security company, and he gets access to security codes and keys and all this stuff. So they have these leads in, and they find this house on this isolated street. They learn the guy has a lot of money because of a news story where he'd gotten a settlement because his daughter was killed in an accident. And so they're like, there's got to be cash in that house. So they scope it out, and one, they realize that the guy is blind. They see him walking around with a white cane. The other, they realize he has this just, like, beast of a Rottweiler. So you've got these, like, so, you know, they wait till night. The guy is blind. He never leaves the house. They decide to break in while he's sleeping. You know, they have device to knock out the dog. They have device to knock out the man. Obviously, they are set up. They are doomed to fail. Otherwise, this movie wouldn't exist.
Sure.
So, but the thing is, you don't know what's going to happen or when. And Alvarez does such a good job of keeping you on your toes. You know, the title comes from these kids in the house doing what they can to not be heard, touched, or smelled. You know, the joke I make is that they're sitting there trying to clench their pores to keep any odors in, or also smell them across the room, because blind people's other senses tend to be a little enhanced. And there's a great scene where, of course, they end up in the basement.
Yes.
And
they may or may not run by the front door on the way to the basement.
Oh, there are a number of logical reasons for why they end up in the basement. But the man is pretty paranoid because he's got a lot of locks. Let's just put it that way. For good reason. And so they end up in the basement, and the guy, like, takes the advantage. He pulls a plug on the electrical box. And Alvarez shoots this sequence with, like, this kind of hazy yellow, it's like a night vision type thing. But it's not that, like, you know, war movie soldier,
right,
night goggle vision thing. It's a necessity, because otherwise it's just a blank screen and you hear bumping and screaming. So you've got this kind of yellowy haze, which enhances, like, the old man who's played by Stephen Lang, who's a really terrific character actor. He was the guy with the scars in Avatar, like the Marine guy, buff Marine guy.
Yes.
And where his facial scars and like his mottled blind eyes just make him look even more like a monster in this yellow haze. And then the kids, and I read that they wore these prosthetic contact lens things to make their pupils look really huge and dilated. So you have this, you have like the monster, and then you have the deer in the headlights look. And it's really, it's the type of imagery that you walk out going, wow, you know, that's a, like, a scary, it's scary and really original, you know, it's something you really haven't seen before. I thoroughly enjoyed this movie. It throws a lot of stuff at you. It surprises you. There are moments of just horrible, excruciating silence, and then the floorboard creaks, you know? And of course, the guy has a gun, and, you know, he's firing literally blind, and, you know, there are a couple of moments where the audience at the screening was just pin drop silent. And then there are moments where they were losing their minds. and I almost regret revealing that, because I don't want to set anybody's expectations too high. But that this movie is designed to create those kind of responses, and it does it really well. I was so thoroughly entertained.
That's awesome.
Yes.
In contrast, since you made me go do this part of the assignment, I can tell you to it is not the one that we're going to hate on this week, but you could probably skip Jason Statham in The Mechanic Resurrection.
Well, yeah, this is the strange incident where you have seen the movie and I haven't.
Right. And I don't have the chops to review it in the way that you do, but I can tell you that even the amazing pool sequence, which is in the trailer — I know you don't watch trailers, but a lot of people do — even that amazing sequence doesn't save the 98 minutes that you have to suffer through this terribly written piece of trash. Like, it's totally forgettable. The fight scenes are awesome Jason Statham fight scenes, but he's one of these guys that I really wish could get out of this rut, and they could put him in fight scenes in a story that you cared about.
Yeah.
Because the premise of this movie, and we'll do it real quick, is like, he's an assassin, and he specializes — if you didn't see the first one, he specializes in making everything look like an accident.
And you probably didn't see the first one.
And the six people that aren't in his family that saw the first one, you know what's going on there. And in this one, he disappears off the planet. Somebody finds him and wants him to do a number of jobs, or they're going to murder his girlfriend that he met literally 6 minutes ago.
Played by
Jessica Alba. Yes. Yeah. So when she's not making Honest Company products, she is acting with Jason Statham and doing it terribly. So you can skip that one.
Yeah, the first Mechanic was memorably unmemorable.
Yeah.
Add this to the pile of sequels.
And and you will notice this if you ever go see it. It's got that Japanese Russian export feel to it. Like, it was like The Raid, except not nearly as good, right? Yeah. It's got that feel, like it just missed a step in rendering to the United States that it didn't translate in the way that it was supposed to, even though it was made here.
And you say you don't have the chops to review a movie. That's a very adroit observation to make.
So there you go.
it's interesting how Don't Breathe has this really simple — it's so conceptually simple, and we kind of touched on this, a while back when we talked about The Shallows.
Yes,
where it's like shark circles girl, and this is like blind man chases kids. The Alvarez kind of really exploits his main set piece for everything it has, and the reason I bring this up is because Hands of Stone, which is not even in the same ballpark genre-wise. It's a biographical story of Roberto Duran, the boxer. But this is one where like it is so remarkably unfocused in comparison to Don't Breathe, which has just such a simple conceptual, no bones stripped down raw kind of thing. Where Hands of Stone is just that. And we've seen this a lot of times in biographies, where you're trying to do too much. This isn't a story; it's a timeline in an encyclopedia.
Yes.
Where it's like, we're going to cover 10 years of this guy's life, it's not as bad as like the Nelson Mandela film from a couple of years ago, which tried to cover like 50 years. And you just, oh my gosh. That movie was better for other reasons. But the Duran film, it's got almost, a handful of subplots they're trying to throw in. At least they're focusing on about a 10 or 12 year period in his life between roughly 1971 and 1983, which was like when he came out of Panama and became a champion and fought Sugar Ray Leonard twice and all that stuff. Beat Sugar Ray Leonard, and then Sugar Ray Leonard in the rematch beat him because Duran — that's the No Mas fight. That's
yes.
the one where he forfeited it in the middle of a round. So at least it has that type of focus, but but it tries to it's kind of bookended by Duran's time when he was trained by a guy named Ray Arcel, who was a legendary figure in boxing for, you know, like from the 20s or 30s to the 50s, you know, and he had retired and came back because of Duran. And one of the reasons he got out of boxing is because he wanted to bring that, like, New York City boxing scene to the masses with TV deals and all
yes.
that stuff.
Yeah.
And the mob pressured him. The mob wanted to control that, wanted to control the sport, and they pressured him, and so he got out before he got a before he ate a
right.
bullet, you know?
Yeah.
So you have it kind of skims on that, and it kind of in the narrative bookends the time when he and Duran worked together, but it never gets into the relationship, the meeting. It's just is there you get a loose sense of kind of mutual respect between the two of them. Duran was a guy who was a wild, brash guy. He'd go in there. He wanted to be wanted everything to be a slugfest.
Yep.
And Arcel is one who teaches him the difference between technique, the short term, and strategy, the long term, you know? But you don't, I mean, did they have like kind of a father-son type relationship? What kind of relationship do they have? It never gets into it. It tries to get into the love story between Duran and his wife. It touches on how the political wranglings between Panama and America over, you know, possession of
sure.
the canal.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
because
it tries to get into that because Duran was, you know, a very patriotic Panamanian, you know, it kind of touches on it of course flashes back to his childhood a little bit where he was, you know, living in poverty and watching the protests against the American occupation of that and any number of things. And it's just trying to do so much in the span of 2 hours that it doesn't do any of it particularly well. Edgar Ramirez plays Roberto Duran. I think from just seeing his kind of presence on the screen, he's the kind of guy who could probably carry the film himself. Robert De Niro plays Ray Arcel. They have a couple of good scenes together, you know, but they're never really the characters are never really exploited or explored in any kind of way that gives them any serious depth. This is where you like beg the filmmaker, you know, take a dramatic liberty with the story.
Right.
Know?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is already, you know, give us some meat here. Give us some meat. And it never really does that. I was kind of disappointed. Notably, Sugar Ray Leonard is played by Usher, the pop
oh,
singer.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And actually he is pretty good too. He's kind of got the demeanor down. He's not I've seen him in a couple other films, and you know he has potential to be a decent actor. And of course the film trying to do everything, you know, has some scenes between Sugar Ray and his wife, you know, as he's preparing for these showdowns with Duran and you're just like these so many scenes really just like whoosh, they're shallow. They kind of go nowhere after a while. And it's like, okay, this movie should have been just about what happened in 1980, which were those two fights. You
yes.
know what I mean?
Well, and that's,
and
that's
that, and that would be the equivalent of taking that one house set piece and exploiting it.
Sure.
Exploiting every corner of
well,
it.
Well, and you know, and when you talk about what's happening in boxing in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, mm-hmm. right? Anyone who enjoys the sweet science or mixed martial arts or professional wrestling knows that, like, between what's going on with the mob and what's going on with McMahon and what's going on in the boxing, like, there are so billions of really interesting stories yeah. happening there that you shouldn't even go there if you can't actually go there.
Yeah.
Like, just ignore all of the insanity that's happening
yeah.
and focus on something you can finish, because I have obviously not seen this movie, but when it would even dip its toe in there, I would immediately be like, come on, you're not going to do it just like, just get out of there and go, yeah, focus on these two fights and make it a really interesting story, because this is the thing that I think is really difficult about making biopics in any genre. It's like you said, you try and do their entire life when the audience has a you know, a thirst for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
What story can you tell me? What story can you tell me in 90 minutes?
Yeah, exactly. Frankly, you could take the contents of Hands of Stone and make 4 or 5 movies.
Sure you could.
You could make a love story. You can make the story about the about Ray Arcel and his troubles. You can make you could make the story about Roberto Duran's childhood.
Yeah.
You know? And you walked out of this movie going, what made Roberto Duran the man he was? I don't know.
Which is a shame. So
I'm kind of bummed. You know, the director, his name is Jonathan Jakubowicz. Sorry if I pronounce that incorrectly. I just feel like he doesn't have a firm grip on the material ever, you know, because one sequence in some ways this is just yet another boxing movie, you know, where Roberto Duran is sort of, I don't know, I mean, he's a complicated guy. In some ways he's a good guy, in some ways he's not, you know. But then towards the end of the movie there, it's just this like, okay, here's another fight. He's coming back. Cheer for him. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
Cheer for him for the sheer, only because we've sat here with him for 2 hours and you're supposed to be on his side. It just doesn't earn those moments. He's also, Jakubowicz is not, like, and this is purely on him. Duran's first fight in the big leagues, you know, after Arcel gets him a fight in America. He goes in and the boxing sequences are just like ridiculous, almost Rocky type of ridiculousness, where it's just a bunch of huge punches being thrown at each other. And you and I know that we don't need extreme realism in boxing movies. We really don't. I appreciate some realism, but what I also appreciate is him visually showing us whether Duran has become a different type of boxer or not.
Sure.
And in just showing the big punches, you aren't showing us if he's learned anything from Ray Arcel in his first fight.
Right.
You know, and it just it's really it misses some of those key moments. So I can't recommend it. I can't recommend Hands of Stone. I'm sorry. And it's especially disappointing because Robert De Niro is finally in a movie that might give him something interesting to do. You know, especially considering his last one was Dirty Grandpa.
Which I know you love. It's one of your top for 16.
Sure. So we're going to move on, and I'm going to quickly touch on Kubo and the Two Strings, which is an animated film from...
is that DreamWorks?
Laika. Who did, I believe, The Box Trolls.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And the one I loved, Coraline. Coraline's amazing movie. Kubo and the Two Strings has that kind of Japanese mythology thing going on. And its protagonist is a young boy who's like... grandfather literally like stole one of his eyes. So you've got this real dark component and when he was a baby and his mom escaped with him, and we catch up with Kubo as, you know, he's living in isolation on a mountain with his mom, and his mom is just sort of sits there traumatized all day, you know. And he has to feed her, like literally put the spoon of rice in her mouth. It's kind of a quest movie where he has to find the armor of his father, who's a great samurai. He's got to find the sword and the armor and the helmet. And visually, it really is a beautiful movie. It's really beautiful. But I was disappointed because the story ends up being pretty boilerplate at times. And I don't know if I was missing something because maybe there are some kind of deep Japanese symbolic myth stuff happening there that I'm missing because maybe I don't have that knowledge base or whatever. But there are elements of it that are really pretty intriguing and elements that are you know, like I said, kind of run-of-the-mill quest story type things. But it's dark. It has the cojones to be dark and a little challenging, you know. So you know, don't take your 5-year-old, take a 10-year-old to this movie. There's a few scary moments. I mean, obviously the kid lost his eye. I mean, that's already a fairly, you know, for a real young audience, that might be rather disturbing. But you know, there are many, many moments in this movie where I just kind of sat back in awe and thought, I wish the story matched the visuals here. I wish the story was as fleshed out. And I may be in the minority here because a lot of people are really loving this movie and it has the makings of potentially being kind of a cult favorite, especially if you're, you know, interested in the kind of manga and other types of Japanese popular culture. But just slightly disappointed by Kubo and the Two Strings. Slightly. It's like I didn't write a full-fledged review of this. I just kind of sneaked out to watch it for my own enjoyment. And this is like a real, I would give it it'd be a 3 out of 4 star kind of movie for me on the strength of the visuals.
Sure.
Absolutely on the strength of the visuals alone. That and Kubo is befriended by a monkey, and I really like monkeys.
All right.
The monkey accompanies him on the quest.
Yes, well, clearly.
And finally, and now.
And now, John Serba hates your favorite movie if your favorite movie may have to do with horses and Jesus.
If Ben-Hur, parentheses, 2016, end parentheses, is your favorite movie, I hate your favorite movie. Now, I frankly thought I would hate this movie more than I did, because the problem is when you are walking into a remake of a movie that is generally considered by the vast majority of people to be a hands-down untouchable classic in many ways. And
sure. I mean, if you know what you're referring to, I mean, like, what you're about to talk about isn't going to be nominated for one Academy Award, let alone 11
of
them.
Yeah, exactly. And how many did Ben-Hur, like, won 9 of them?
Yeah.
9 out of 11, if I recall correctly. But the thing everybody remembers about that is the chariot race. And I think they... the budget of the original 1959 Ben-Hur, not the original, but the original was
1925, right? Yeah. Silent movie, blah blah blah,
et cetera, et cetera. But
you're one of 5 people who know all the Ben-Hur trivia that you need. So,
well, I have to.
If you're going to go to Buffalo Wild Wings and try and win movie trivia night, and they might talk about Ben-Hur, you know who to call.
I'll be your lifeline. just bring home a. Bring home a teriyaki wing for me.
Just a single wing for that
just
answer.
One wing. You know, it's 50 cent wing night. It's cheap. I'm a cheap.
It's a quest movie. Dick. You got to bring back a chicken wing.
So the centerpiece of the 1959 Ben-Hur was that chariot race. At the time, I think it was the most expensive movie ever made. They spent $17 million.
Yeah. I mean, it was a lot. And they, like, you know, they killed extras. They killed horses. Like, it was a crazy movie that they made.
Yeah. And the remake is directed by Timur Bekmambetov, the Russian director who did Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, not so great, Wanted, significantly better. And in Night Watch and Day Watch, which were the
his two breakthrough Russian films.
He knows what he's doing behind the camera, and that is really let me put an asterisk on that statement. He knows what he's doing behind the camera with action sequences.
Yes.
Not necessarily big on like actors and drama.
Yes.
Because there's a kind of restless quality to the way he directs movies that is like, will you please stop moving the camera? It's two people talking. You know? And my assertion is that he does that to distract us from the fact that there's just like there's a 5-watt light bulb of drama going on here. It's just real low wattage dullness when the film slows down and the people talk. And I kind of chalk it up to his cast. He has a pretty unremarkable cast. He cast Jack Houston as Judah Ben-Hur when he needs a Fassbender or something, someone who can bring a kind of thespian quality.
And I think in both cases, because, and these are not the same movie, but in the same way that you cannot believe that Jason Statham and Jessica Alba are madly in love after 6 minutes, like, this entire movie hinges on the idea of forgiveness between two brothers, and one of whom goes off to war and then ends up declaring war on his adopted family.
Yeah.
And at no point in that first 20 minutes do I believe for a second that there's any tension between the Jew and the not Jew.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the one knock that people have against the 1959 Ben-Hur is it's like almost 4 hours long.
Sure.
This is a 2-hour version of that. I'd rather watch 4 hours of, you know, fulfilling drama that takes the time to develop things like that instead of this where it's just knocking it out.
And that is very check the boxy, like a corporate movie checklist of things you need to do. And the real shame of it, and we were talking yesterday as we were preparing for today, the real shame of it is from the chariot race, and I'm not going to spoil, this is the third movie made in the 15th play, like you should know how this movie ends, right? But like from the chariot race to the crucifixion to Judah and his brother rekindling their relationship, like it's pretty well done for the last half, considering what you have to suffer through in the first half to even get there. Like they figure, you know, like in music, they call it finding the song. You play the song enough until you find what it's supposed to sound like. It feels like they found the movie in the last 30 or 35 minutes when you're like, okay, I can settle in and enjoy this, because the chariot race is pretty remarkable, I think. And then I think because it's so good, you give up on the fact that the drama is going to be terrible and then you're good with whatever.
Well, it's worth noting that they do change it from the 1959 version where Masala, Judah's adopted brother, best friend, etc., actually dies in the chariot race. He does not die in this movie.
He might as well. I mean,
yeah. Well, I mean, and no one cares either way.
No, and that's a problem with the movie. But like, what they do to him, like he would live like an hour and a half.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. I mean, how many horses could trample you before you died? Not many. It's worth noting that, like, you know, obviously technology being what it is, and this is, I think, the only reason, this is my theory, the only reason this Ben-Hur exists is because of technology. That is arguably why they remade the 1925 Ben-Hur for 1959.
Sure, yeah.
Because in 1925, it was a silent movie, it was black and white. 1959, they have color. They have
Charlton Heston.
You know, they have a newly established method of telling a story in an even more spectacular way. I mean, the chariot race is rooted in that 1925 movie. That is the center point of that movie as well. Yep. You know, so I think part of it is like, hey, well, you know, it's the CGI era. Ben-Hur needs to be remade with some computers. And so you go into the movie with your dukes up, like, the how
Yeah, well, and I told you because I had to see, I had to go through two different screenings. One in which the CGI wasn't done, so yeah. I got to see a very weird version of the chariot race, and then one where it was actually finished. And I explain this to everybody who asks me about this movie is that the crux of how terrible the storytelling aspect is encapsulated in a single scene in the first, let's call it, 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And Jonah Ben-Hur and his wife are walking through the square. And the Romans have a guy up on a pedestal, and they're like, this Jewish man has done something against the Roman Empire. We're going to crucify him. They take his tomato, their potato sack off, and they reveal he's somebody from the neighborhood, right? Yeah. And Ben-Hur turns to his wife and says, this is terrible. We need to get rid of them and get them out of Jerusalem and get our city back. And as he's having this monologue, the camera is slowly panning. And as it slowly pans, there's a door, and a man is sanding the door. And then all of a sudden, you're introduced to this old Jesus house, because Jesus is a carpenter, if you didn't know, because exactly. This is the clumsy way in which we're going to introduce you to Jesus and his dovetail joint. And I literally, the first time I saw it was like mouth agape. Really? Like, you're in
a room. The world's most humble sanding block.
Right. You're in a writing room, and this is how, like, this is how you do this.
They should have just slapped a tool belt on him.
Right, like, and he should have
put a pencil behind his ear.
And, you know, he steps into frame, and he goes, all right, today, kids, we're going to teach you how to make a new door for your house that will keep all the Romans out.
It's a very clumsy movie in that way. You know, I also think... I can't. One of the biggest distractions of the movie to me was during the chariot race. I am not arguing with the method in which it was shot, the shots that Bekmambetov chooses, the way it's edited, anything like that. It is not the herky jerky, you know,
shaky cam editing.
That you sometimes get.
If you're picturing Michael Bay and horses, that is not what this chariot race
is. No. In fact, it's a fairly well-conceived chariot race. But the problem is you're going to be sitting there in 2016 looking for the seams and the special effects. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a digital shot. It has to be because it has horses flipping over and breaking their necks, and they can't do that in movies anymore.
Pause for a second. They should not do that.
Like, the movie wouldn't get released if they had, frankly.
Yeah, well, you should not teach.
So it's not
teach horses
happen.
Gymnastics. That is not what we should be doing.
which isn't to say let's go back to the old ways when they mangled horses for real. But like there were ways to work around that were clever, mm-hmm. You know. And I am not that old man sitting up there. They don't make movies like they used to. I'm not that person. You know, not at all. But when you have something that iconic to compare it to, you are way more apt to pick it apart.
Iconic in two ways. So you have a chariot race that wins 11 Academy Awards, mm-hmm. that is shoehorned is too harsh. I'm at a loss for words today, so I apologize. But like that is connected to the greatest story ever told, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how many ways can you tell the story of Jesus and mm-hmm. his, you know, rise to prominence at 33 years? Like,
yeah,
you have that going on, and then you have this chariot race, and you're trying to get it all to fit together. And again, it's 2016 where we're looking for CGI seams, and you're telling us a story we've heard no less than 11 trillion times.
What, you don't know what happens to when Jesus meets Pontius Pilate?
I had no idea what happens when he meets Pontius Pilate or when he's up on a cross with the lead singer of Linkin Park. I didn't know.
Which lead singer of Linkin Park? There are two.
It was clearly, it's always Chester Bennington. It's always Chester Bennington.
Oh, you should have said lead singer of Stone Temple Pilots. He's not the lead singer of Stone Temple Pilots anymore. But
There
is your B-dubs trivia night.
There right is, there. Yes. The half an album that Chester Bennington sat on STP.
Oh, you're ridiculing this movie way more than I could.
Well probably because I had to see it more twice. Times than you did.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, it's not that I wanted to hate it, because I genuinely do that part-time job because, as I tell you every time, like, I just love this medium.
Oh,
I will
sure.
watch anything.
For sure.
But I just think, like, you needed somebody, much like your critique of Hans' story, you needed somebody who could tell a story. Yeah. Because anybody in 2016, I'm sorry to all filmmakers out there, anyone with a computer can make CGI horses that run into one another. Mm-hmm. That's not the hard part. Mm-hmm. The hard part is making me care before we get there.
Yeah. It is worth noting that there's a sequence when Judah Ben-Hur is enslaved on a ship rowing.
Yeah.
And rowing. And rowing.
It's too long.
And then there's some more rowing.
It's too long.
And rowing.
It's...
And rowing. And it actually turns into something that's almost really good. Well, it is really good. It's almost great.
It's the way
Bekmambetov puts it together.
It's just, it doesn't belong in the movie. Like, it's fantastic, but it just, it feels like we went someplace different for like a half hour. And then we're back.
But that's his story. The story is he's enslaved. But what I'm getting to is he is in the galley of this Roman ship, rowing with all these guys, and then the Greeks attack them. They're ramming the boats, and it is entirely from that like below deck point of view. And I think that's actually pretty exhilarating because. You're not seeing things. The tension draws from hearing what's going on and hearing the voices above, and then all of a sudden the wood is exploding and splintering, and all that. In that sense, it's actually a pretty remarkable sequence in many ways, and that's why I didn't just completely, you know, get out both swords in both hands and slice this movie apart. It's because there are a couple of instances like that where there's some good filmmaking happening here. You know, I still don't. Jack Huston does not have the presence to carry a film to play Ben-Hur. Toby Kebbell plays Masala. No, Rodrigo Santoro plays Jesus. He's got like four scenes. Why is he third billed? Morgan Freeman turns up as the kind of chariot race promoter.
Yeah, he's essentially a race promoter. I mean,
he's like STP to Richard Petty or something. Who sponsors Richard Petty?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, but, right, exactly. Like he sponsors racers. There's a brief moment in the story that they allude to the fact that he might have done this at one time, but is far too old. But they never delve into it because why would you do that?
Yeah,
right?
Why would you get too deeply into that character when you haven't gotten deep into the Ben-Hur character?
You know, and he looks at times like a cast off from the Star Wars universe. Like he doesn't look like he fits there. Like if at any point he had taken out a lightsaber and killed one of the horses, it would not have seemed out of place.
Played by Morgan Freeman with really long, big gray dreadlocks. And if that doesn't take you out of the experience of watching the movie, nothing will. Now, I hate your favorite movie if it's Ben-Hur, (2016). Close.
I can tell you the fact that it has made $15,100,000, that it's nobody's favorite movie.
No, not at all. And it's going to die a slow death. Maybe it'll make some more money overseas. Type of movie that might do more elsewhere.
They spent $100 million to make it, $100 million to promote it. They were praying, no pun intended. They were praying to make $20 million the first weekend with any hope of getting this back. And you and I were talking a little bit that this was clearly aimed at a particular sect of humanity that just didn't bite on it. And
there's that kind of. Very mildly kind of evangelical tone to the scenes with Jesus in them.
Yeah,
in the sense that in that kind of Christian movie sense, but it does not by any means.
No. But I guess
take the movie.
I'm wondering if for the amount of these giant epics that don't seem to get any traction, if this would have been. I said this to you yesterday, so I will say it on record. You know, I wonder if this would have done better around the holidays. For sure,
and then you get a real actor, a real cast,
1,000%. Because you could anchor it, and then you could go up against Star Wars with something that isn't Star Wars.
Yeah,
it was the wrong time with a cast that wasn't strong enough with a director who cannot do drama
and no reason to exist,
and really no reason to exist.
So to recap, don't see Ben-Hur.
No.
You can skip Hands of Stone too. Kubo and the Two Strings. I feel like I should probably go back and rewatch Kubo. See if I can get more out of it this time. Maybe I just didn't catch that wave the first time. And finally, Don't Breathe is remarkable. Really a terrific movie. Pure entertainment. Pure kind of physical exhilaration. It's R-rated too. It's not one of those not one of those wimpy PG-13
which are the worst,
horror movies.
Literally the worst. It's like when you see Wolverine as PG-13, you're like, oh man.
Yeah. Oh man. Don't Breathe, rated R. Go see it. Thanks for listening.